Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the fourth episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today we're talking about part three of Act One, Scene Two. This final section of Scene Two is Horatio's revelation to Hamlet about the ghost of his father, because it treads over the same narrative ground as Act One, and does so more dramatically, which is to say, without speeches about historical context. This scene is often used to justify cutting Scene One. Consequently, many versions of the play will have us meet Horatio and the soldiers here. Either way, it's the scene where Hamlet and Horatio's friendship is first explored. The relationship, as written, makes Horatio the commoner and Hamlet the aristocrat. But despite the conventions of class that subjugate one to the other, there is also friendly camaraderie between them. Hamlet teases his fellow student, and Horatio is self-deprecating, as per their respective hierarchical positions. But they're still able to share a private joke. They're equals on the academic level. Hamlet has much the same relationship with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern later, though the missing element there is love. They are false friends, while Horatio is a true friend. By doubling RNG, Shakespeare also indirectly doubles Horatio's worth. If their characters are balanced against each other in the play, it takes two of Hamlet's treacherous friends to balance Horatio's loyalty. Though Hamlet has kept quiet about his opposition to his mother's hasty marriage to this point, this is the moment where he opens up. Certainly he's spoken of it to himself in the soliloquy, but here makes Horatio his sounding board. Horatio is in many ways Hamlet's control subject. He's Hamlet without the tragic experience. Loss of a father, or whoring of a mother, from the same school, literally, and of thought. When Hamlet speaks to Horatio, he might as well be talking to himself. And in Horatio, we might see what Hamlet was before his father died. As we'll see shortly, both men have the same open but skeptical mind vis-a-vis the supernatural. What is perhaps stranger is that Hamlet opens up in front of Bernardo and Marcellus. Does he know these men to be loyal to his father rather than to the new king? Or are soldiers, like servants, considered insignificant, mute and dumb? Let me read an exchange. Hamlet says, "My father, methinks I see my father." To which Horatio responds, "Where, my lord?" Hamlet then says, "In my mind's eye, Horatio." And Horatio responds, "I saw him once. He was a goodly king." Now, it'd be natural for Horatio to wonder here if the ghost hasn't already appeared to Hamlet. Later, we get more on the social class of the soldiers. Horatio tells their bit of the story as if it were his own. As Hamlet's friend and a learned man, he may be better at telling it, but on a class level, perhaps he is closer to Hamlet's position than they are, and he would never speak directly to the prince unless asked to. Hamlet can hear this and trust it from Horatio, but maybe not from the soldiers alone. There's a line in there in which Horatio says that the soldiers stand dumb and speak not to him, by which he means the ghost, and nor do they speak to Hamlet, who is an echo of his dread father. Hamlet does interrogate them after this, and they get some lines. And in this interrogation, he tries to catch the men in a lie, like badly describing his father to confirm it really was his ghost. This is all part of Hamlet's skepticism. He asks about specific details to see if the trio's story is consistent. So Hamlet agrees to go and talk to the ghost on the next watch, and gets a short aside once Horatio and company are gone, in which he ponders just why his father's spirit has not been allowed to rest. He suspects something already, his prophetic soul later, since his own spirit cannot find rest in the world of the living. Before going further, I'd like to read comments made to me by my late friend Brian Snell on the subject of Horatio. He says, "Nice thoughts upon Horatio. I've been doing some thinking about him recently when rereading the introduction of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. It made me think, hey, what's Horatio? Chopped liver? Why send away for his old friends when you've already got one to talk to right here in Elsinore? Did the royal couple perceive that Horatio was too loyal to spy on Hamlet for them? Was he too low a commoner for them to talk to? Did they even know he was in Elsinore? It is interesting that, except for one brief shouted line in Act 5, Scene 1, that's frequently cut or drowned out, Horatio never shares so much of a word with anybody else in the court. Not Gertrude, not Polonius, not Ophelia, not Laertes. Even with the Gravedigger and Osric, he directs his comments to Hamlet rather than to them, dependent upon staging, of course. Then suddenly, he does get rather chatty when Fortinbras shows up. If it weren't for talking with Bernardo and Marcellus, Horatio wouldn't speak to anyone but Hamlet, almost like a ghost himself. With the right cuts, you could stage this like Fight Club, so the audience thinks Hamlet and Horatio are separate people until the big reveal and the saner Ed Norton portion of his personality, which is Horatio, is what survives at the end. But as I told Snell, as there are a few instances where he does speak or is spoken to by people other than Hamlet, we must reject this interpretation, in the literal sense, that is. Dramatically, it's much the same as if he were just a part of Hamlet's psyche. Okay, let's talk about the adaptations, starting as usual with Branagh's 1996 version. As long as we're in the ballroom, the shot remains unbroken. Branagh's Hamlet may visually be a cinematographic feast, but it's still squarely in the realm of theater, and the performances are probably the better for it. As Horatio and the soldiers walk in, Hamlet, coming out of his first soliloquy, is on autopilot. He gives them greeting without recognizing them. Here is a man who's received everyone's condolences and congratulations already, most of them hypocritical in his view, so there's a little bit of a double take when he realizes who it is. Though Hamlet is quite happy to see Horatio, there is no loving embrace as there sometimes is in other versions. Branagh tries to earn their later intimacy here, keeping it to a friendly and enthusiastic shaking of hands. When performed, the lines take on their full meanings, and I keep noticing things I wouldn't normally have just from reading the text. For example, how long has it been since Hamlet saw Horatio? They were at Wittenberg together, but Hamlet's probably been home less than 2 months since his father's death. It could be less, travel being a slow proposition in this era, like Horatio arrives late for the funeral, right? So he might have not gotten the news until late as well, then undertaken the trip, and so arrives with his mother already in the arms of another man. There's no real sense that he was at Elsinore when his father's murder occurred. And yet the line, "I am glad to see you well," and the actor's performance seem to have the two friends separated for a good length of time. Is this just more of the play's elastic time? Time is out of joint again. On the matter of Hamlet and Horatio not being of the same social class, Hamlet still likes to consider him as if he were, part and parcel of his gracious princeliness. When Horatio calls himself Hamlet's servant, Hamlet responds with an equalizing comment. "I'll change that name with you." He accepts neither of Horatio's attempts at self-deprecation, when he calls himself servant or truant, because he places his friend on par with himself, and he is neither. Hamlet's answer to that, "I would not hear your enemy say so, nor shall you do mine ear that violence." It just hit me. How could I never have noticed that this foreshadows the circumstances of his father's death? "Do mine ear that violence." Note also the difference between Marcellus and Bernardo. Marcellus is addressed by name, so Hamlet knows him. Cast as an older man, he probably served under his father, and Hamlet trusts him. Bernardo is only addressed as Sir, and barely at all, leading me to believe Hamlet doesn't know who he is. In effect, Horatio and Marcellus are vouching for him by allowing him to be present. Thanks to the actor's quiet intensity, another line I'm picking up here is,
"He was a man. Take him for all in all."
Hamlet has just spent some time deifying him with analogies of Hyperion and Zeus, but now he's just a man. God or ghost, Hamlet Sr. is now a creature of the supernatural, and one of Hamlet's difficulties is figuring out on which side of the afterlife his father rests. It also puts in question whether Claudius is a man at all, since he does not compare to, say, Hyperion, and Hyperion is analogous now to man. I'll try to remember this line when we get to Hamlet's "What is a man?" speech, where again, man is like a god. Then, change of venue and the first camera cut since Claudius and Gertrude left the stage. Hamlet says, "Let me hear," but doesn't want to do it in the open. We soon understand why, as he steps into a secret passage and then to the study. The ballroom is full of access points from which someone might spy or catch the characters in conversation. As Horatio tells the story, there's a cute moment from Jack Lemmon as Marcellus that I never noticed before. On Horatio's whilst they, distilled almost to jelly with the act of fear, stand dumb, Marcellus gives him a look. It's the only time he takes his eyes off Hamlet. In fact, all eyes are on the protagonist's reactions. As if in slight outrage that Horatio would calumniate him like that. And yet, he can't quite mount a defense. Horatio is on Hamlet's level, and he's just a lowly guard. It's not his place to speak, and he has to bear it. It's a nice, subtle character moment that goes with the exasperation evident elsewhere in the play. First, Horatio won't believe him about the ghost, and later he's forced to swear multiple times. "We've sworn already," he cries. I know I said Hamlet's questions about the ghost could be a kind of test to see if the trio really saw what they think they saw, but Branagh doesn't really play on that. Instead, his Hamlet seems worried about the state of his father's spirit. Looked he frowningly? And still, he mistrusts the apparition from the first. If it assumes my noble's father's person, implies a doppelganger. He'll have to see for himself. Then he lets Horatio and the soldiers out from yet another secret door. The staging continues to support the paranoia and conspiratorial mood of the play. When they're gone, Hamlet starts speaking in voiceover for a line and a half before using his voice again, something he also did at the start of scene two. Branagh keeps bouncing between the two modes, keeping it dynamic, but also for believability's sake. The voiceover section comes while his friends might still be in earshot. Hamlet's reaction is a scholarly one. He goes to his books and he looks up demons. He calls the ghost his father's spirit, but also doubts some foul play. One could think he means the murder of his father with the latter line, but they are more likely misgivings about the identity of the spirit. The book in his hands underscores that interpretation and supports the action of the end of Act 2, Scene 2, as well as Hamlet's doubts over the ghost's motives. Back in 1948, Olivier actually follows the soliloquy with Scene 3, placing it almost simultaneous with the end of Scene 2. At the end of it, Ophelia sees Hamlet from afar in the position we left him in, and he sees her. But more on this when we sink our teeth into Scene 3. The end of Scene 2 follows that moment, with three shadows falling across Hamlet's way. As usual, Hamlet does not recognize Horatio right away, here because his friend is just a shadow. He must come out of his own gloom to actually see him. Through the staging, the idea of a castle full of ghosts resonates. Not only is there a ghost walking about, but the way the camera moves is spirit-like. Lovers glimpse each other from afar, haunting each other in plain sight, as if they were visions. And there's the play of shadows seen here. Hamlet could be alone in the castle as shades solidify in his presence. Unlike Branagh's Hamlet and Horatio, Olivier's don't share a joke at this point. In fact, there's an awkward moment created by Horatio when he tells Hamlet he came for the funeral. Instead of letting Horatio off the hook with terse humor, as in the Branagh version, Hamlet puts him on the spot, practically accusing him of being insincere.
"I pray you do not mock me, fellow student. I think it was to see my mother's wedding."
The Hamlet-Horatio relationship is much more hierarchical in this film, with Horatio clearly afraid of Hamlet and his moods. And he should be. Olivier's Hamlet does try to catch the trio in a mistake. Quite confrontational. Listen.
"Armed, say you?"
"Armed, my lord."
"From top to toe?"
"My lord, from head to foot."
"Then you saw not his face?"
"Oh, yes, my lord. He wore his visor up."
The whole matter of the ghost is introduced as Hamlet looks into the distance, so that when he says, "Methinks I see my father," Horatio thinks he really did see him there. An understandable mistake, if a bit on the nose with the staging. Once the three men have left, Hamlet is alone with his thoughts once again. Olivier puts emphasis on the fact his father's spirit is in arms, which we have to look at. Hamlet Sr. appearing as a warrior, when he wasn't killed in that uniform, is significant. The spirit goes to war against the new regime, representative of old values bucking against the new. His last appearance in his wife's closet is the only one where he is wearing something else. In that scene, he restrains Hamlet's violent temper. His intentions are different regarding Claudius than those regarding Gertrude, and he wears the proper attire for each. The scene ends with a fade to black, as if prompted by Hamlet's prayer that night were come. And as we cut to night, we understand why someone would play scene 3 before this. Olivier wants to end on that line, that effect, and the scene where Hamlet confronts the ghost. So the conversation between Polonius and Ophelia has to have already happened. Jump ahead to 1980, where I have to admit, I have trouble sizing up Derek Jacobi's Hamlet sometimes. He always gives wonderful line readings, but I'm not always sure they fit together from moment to moment. his Hamlet is incredibly mercurial, perhaps unstable from the first time we see him. Is his Hamlet truly mad? And since when has he been so? Let me try to explain. In this case, Hamlet does embrace a hesitant Horatio. This Hamlet is cut off from other characters. He's poorly attended and latches onto the first friendly, or should I say neutral, face he sees. From Horatio's awkwardness, one can imagine Hamlet making him a closer friend than he really is, letting him into a secret and personal world he would not have been privy to outside of this crisis. The same goes for Marcellus to a lesser extent, and he really doesn't know Bernardo, Jacobi throwing in a moment of non-recognition quite beautifully. Throughout the scene, the soldiers will stay back, accentuating the hierarchical class structure we've previously discussed. Farther from Hamlet in class than Horatio is, they stand at a remove from him, even on their lines. As in Olivier's staging, Horatio does a double take when he hears that Hamlet sees his father. Jacobi's Hamlet responds differently, though. He's hurt, as if Horatio is joking and/or being insensitive. This may spur a quick change in Hamlet's mood, as he becomes rather argumentative after this point. Perhaps it's Horatio's fault in trying to get back into Hamlet's good graces after this faux pas, but Hamlet is troubled by his friend seeming to tell him what he wants to hear. And we can compare this to the fawning Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Is this yet another false friend? The questions about the ghost have very much the bent of a test. Hamlet hardly lets him answer before he asks another question, keeping him unbalanced and holding a distrustful expression.
What look to you, frowningly?
A countenance more in sorrow than in anger.
Pale or red?
Nay, very pale.
And fixed his eyes upon me.
Most constantly.
I would I had been there.
It would have much amazed you.
Very like, very like.
If Hamlet and Horatio are mirrors of a kind, then we can also interpret Hamlet's reaction as that of a skeptic. He doesn't wholly believe the story of a ghost, just as Horatio didn't. Even once he accepts their story, he remains sarcastic with them, even in his show of love. When he then talks about foul play, does he fear a hoax? Usually the line is about some foul deed that has led to a revenant leaving its grave. But here may refer to the revenant's validity. Is it that he thinks his father should not be in armor if he does walk this earth? Say he wasn't buried in his armor, for example. In which case, that hoax may also be from hell itself. It's a spirit, but it's not his father's. Now, as with Olivier's interpretation, Zeffirelli's places scene 3 before this part of scene 2. Further, again, elongating or muddling, I want to say, the timeline. And as with Olivier, this allows him to cut straight to the night of Hamlet's encounter with the ghost when the scene ends. In this version, Hamlet seems to have been waiting for Horatio. Though he welcomes him to Elsinore, he shows no surprise. I do forget myself is almost more of a friendly form of address. In Zeffirelli's elastic timeline, Horatio may have been there for some time and only now gets an audience with the prince, who has to be said, kept largely to himself in dark rooms. We do know that the ghost appeared to him only yesternight, so this may place his appearance at well after the incestuous wedding. It's hard to say. It's our first look at Horatio, played by Stephen Delane. He doesn't look quite as posh as other Horatios do, but the film's medieval stylings make almost everyone look like they're men-at-arms rather than scholars. Speaking of soldiers, three accompany Horatio rather than two. Is this a misreading of the play that would include Francisco in the party? Looks like the actor is credited as such. Strange, given that all three are relegated to bit parts. I'm thinking that scene one might have been filmed, but wound up on the cutting room floor. Their presence gives Hamlet pause. Why are they following him so closely? What are they doing there in the company of his fellow student? He momentarily mistrusts the situation, and yet he speaks on. Among the snips and cuts made to the scene is Hamlet's in my mind's eye, but it's clear where Hamlet actually sees his father. I still grieve for the figure of speech. The line is no doubt cut because the ghost has not yet appeared in the story, nor even been revealed. Horatio's question, where, would have seemed bizarre without our knowledge of its existence. Horatio's role may have been cut down to size, but Delane still makes him the doubter of the excised scene one, by showing embarrassment about what he must tell Hamlet.
My lord, I think I saw him yesternight.
Saw? Who?
My lord, the king, your father.
Look, I know what I'm going to say will sound mad, but bear with me. Perfectly pitched between two students of the same skeptical school. However, It is my belief that the staging of the telling of the tale works against its actual intent. Through another change of venue, Horatio and his merry men lead Hamlet to a more secluded spot. He takes him by the arm and he tells the story while walking. If there was ever an adaptation of the play where Horatio was set up as an evil mastermind, this is how you would do it. Though I'm sure it was done to keep things energetic, the image is that of the prince being taken for a ride. Because remember, in this version, we, the audience, haven't seen the ghost as yet. Horatio could be fabricating the whole thing, and Hamlet may just be unstable enough to hallucinate the ghost later. And we'll explore that in the staging of later scenes. As soon as there's talk of his father's spirit, Hamlet seems completely taken in, overwhelmed by emotion, which Gibson usually plays as being about to throw up. The biggest cut in the scene is the test. This Hamlet does not doubt, nor does he question, which is at cross purposes with his earlier mistrust. If Horatio is trying to bring him down, we have to show it, visually, since the lines don't support it. Zeffirelli does not, and so the impression we get from this scene must be considered a flaw in the direction. Another change brought on by cutting the test. And perhaps the reason why it was actually cut is the removal of any mention of the ghost's armor. When we finally see the ghost, he's not in fact dressed in armor, but in black robes. In losing scene 1 and the Norway plot from scene 2, we've already lost any mention of Denmark ever being at war. That in turn removes the ambiguity of Hamlet Sr.'s relationship with Gertrude. If he was not gone to the wars, it may indicate that there was no room for an affair, nor any overlap between the two brothers. We'll have to stay sharp when looking at future lines on this topic. In Hamlet 2000, there's a buzz at the door, interrupting Hamlet's soliloquy. It's Horatio, his girlfriend Marcella, the female Marcellus, and Elsinore's security guard Bernardo. It's our first introduction to all these characters, done in a way to reduce their importance in the story. Bernardo's uniform places him at the bottom of the security totem, well, under police and military. Marcellus, the role ripped from its soldierly roots, becomes an accessory to Horatio, and Horatio himself is a cold Brit with a modern accent whose more cynical, so also modern, relationship with Hamlet borders on the aloof. Hamlet is consequently a lot more incredulous, which makes sense in a modern context where ghosts are largely relegated to superstition. Instead of an embrace, this Horatio gets a curt, "What make you from Wittenberg?" As in, "What are you doing here?" Their relationship is harsher, it's less tender, but probably just as honest. In this version, the various cut lines prevent Hamlet from correcting Horatio when he calls himself a truant, so we might wonder what kind of people this Hamlet runs around with. His lifestyle doesn't match his parents, that's for sure. The story of the ghost is seen for the first time as a flashback we discussed along with Act 1, Scene 1 in our first episode, and the movie recreates a fog-bound Denmark on a black-and-white security monitor. Though getting it secondhand like this, we might be inclined to mistrust Horatio's tall tale, but the teller's anxiety is shown through the way they nervously smoke. Helpful, seeing as Carl Geary's performance as Horatio is entirely too stone-faced to be much use. Despite Hamlet's misgivings, he doesn't really test the story, in large part because the cut lines refer to armor and beards and other details that film's aesthetic doesn't make use of. A strange mistranslation occurs in one of his final lines. "I'll require your loves." It's "requite your loves" in the text. Turns a promise into a demand. It works for the harsher, more spoiled Hamlet, but still sounds wrong to the trained ear. For the short aside that follows, director Michael Almereyda uses some tricks taken from Olivier. He has the camera follow Hamlet from a strange angle, as if representing the ghost's point of view. Another reason why we, the audience, should trust Horatio's story. And he uses voiceover rather than have Ethan Hawke speak aloud, which is pretty standard, but also creates the effect of the ghost's presence. The ghost is overhearing his thoughts. In Fodor's more experimental contemporary version, Horatio and the soldiers, quote-unquote, board Hamlet during the wedding party. Hamlet does not, however, have a talk with his parents, nor intone his soliloquy. This is intercut with other parts of scene 2 and 3, all going on simultaneously. And without Hamlet's usual introduction, Fodor is free to rid him of his melancholy, and in fact, this Hamlet seems mostly amused by the proceedings, including the tale of his father's ghost. Throughout the scene, he's distracted by Ophelia, who from her point of view is in the middle of scene 3, constantly looking over to her. Our first introduction to Hamlet brands him as the white pawn, with on-screen text. This is an important shift from other versions of the play. First of all, his color is white, as is that of Claudius and Gertrude, whereas Polonia, Ophelia, and Laertes are red, two families pitted against one another in a grand chess game. By making Hamlet the pawn, Fodor robs the character of his power. Usually, Hamlet dictates the terms of the play. We say Olivier's Hamlet, for example, not because he directed it, but because he played the title role. It's what's inside the actor that changes our understanding of the play because the character is the play. Hamlet is not a pawn, he rules this universe, and the plot is resolved only when he says he's ready. But not here. The experimentalism of the film is what often takes center stage, and the unknown actor who plays Hamlet has less to bring to the role. And by this, I don't mean to slight William Bellchambers, but rather that the director has cut many of his lines and moments, choosing to make the mise-en-scène the real star of the show. Making him the pawn weakens him before the other characters, including his female Horatio, who is more driven than he is. Speaking of Horatio, I happen to think Katie Redden Clancy's performance is one of the better things about this version. Here she's dubbed the White Knight. In the film's chess metaphor, that makes her equivalent to Laertes. Both are strong influences in the lives of their respective pawns, Hamlet and Ophelia, and in this version, both are resentful of the pawn's romance. Laertes as scripted and Horatio from her attitude. The knight is a driving influence, the motive horse, to the pawn's more limited movement, and better able to see the big picture, accounting for the knight's ability to jump over other pieces. The chess metaphor is an interesting way to look at the royal relationships in the play, but it is not pursued beyond these introductions. It's doubtful in any case that it could have carried through to the end and still made sense. By virtue of being intercut with other moments, we do not see Horatio approach Hamlet. She's already telling the ghost story when we get to her. The scene is played unlike any other versions, being even more cynical than Hamlet 2000's. Hamlet is dismissive, sarcastic, and aloof, punching holes in Horatio's story while she loses patience with his attitude, rewarding sarcasm with sarcasm. His questions are treated like stupid ones, to be answered in a you-know-very-well-what-I-mean tone. Rolling eyes, all that. They have a very familiar relationship, in the absence of any class system, of course. But it's definitely argumentative. Part of the reason may be Horatio's new gender, having Hamlet and Ophelia as an item and Horatio strictly relegated to the so-called friend zone, creates sexual tension between them. Hamlet isn't just laughing at the ghost story, he's also distracted by Ophelia. He's dismissing Horatio herself, not just the story, and this creates a noticeable spark. In the end, he agrees to do the watch with them tonight, which Horatio accepts with a silent okay. It's the best she's going to get, given the situation. As written, Hamlet is looking for a reason to kill his uncle, and then a reason not to. But in Fodor's Hamlet, we have an oblivious Hamlet who cares nothing about his mother's new husband until the ghost actually forces a promise out of him. In the Tenet version, Hamlet hears steps behind him, quickly wipes a tear, and walks off camera as Horatio and the soldiers walk in. As soon as he sees who it is, we get an excited embrace. The soldiers remain at attention in the background. The staging contrasts intimate relationship and the more hierarchical relationship between prince and soldiers, and so gives us a Horatio that is closer to Hamlet than in many versions. I've spoken before of the divide that exists between the two friends, but here we get the feeling Hamlet sees Horatio as an equal. The soldiers may well fear that admitting to seeing a ghost could lead to reprisals, which is a reasonable motivation for them to go to Horatio first. In this scene, they let him take the lead and tell their story. Marcellus only jumps in when Horatio hesitates, like showing he doesn't know Elsinore very well and he needs prompting as to what the location is called. Without Horatio finding the right details to convince Hamlet, would the prince have believed this story? It's all about trust. Horatio, after all, is an educated man like he is, one not prone to superstition. Horatio has trouble bringing himself to tell the story because it doesn't fit his or their worldview. This version plays very much like Horatio at first chickens out.
My lord, I think I saw him yesternight.
He has to steel himself to finally say he saw him yesternight. As for Hamlet, Tennant continues to play the grief as waves of sadness that sometimes assail the character, his voice breaking in points, but on an even keel otherwise. In my experience, that's exactly what grief is like. His body language changes with the talk of a ghost. He crosses his arms, a barrier of doubt between himself and the other characters. Though he tests them at first, especially the soldier's loyalty, perhaps thinking Horatio is their dupe, he soon believes. Now, there are a number of small cuts in this scene, a line here and there. One line's absence in particular reveals something about the text. Would I had met my dearest foe in heaven, or ever I had seen that day Horatio. That's cut. Usually, it comes just before my father methinks I see my father. There's a dramatic irony here. As Hamlet mentions in succession, heaven and his father, one line may well inspire the other. But Hamlet is about to find out that his father is actually in hell. Later, he'll be unable to kill the praying Claudius from fear he would send him to heaven, which indeed would have sent his dearest foe there. Heaven and hell, another mirrored reflection in the play, and the two brothers each on the wrong side. Now, if we talk about the comics for a minute, the original Classics Illustrated spent a lot of time on the first ghost scene, and so little on scene two that it felt no need recapping Horatio's story a mere two panels after it happened. In fact, all of scene two is reduced to two panels, the first of which was the soliloquy. The gist of this part of the scene is simply told in a caption, with Hamlet's short aside featured in a thought bubble, the equivalent of the voiceover technique. It's economical even if it removes any nuances in the Hamlet-Horatio relationship. Conversely, Mandrake spends two pages on this part of the scene in the modern Classics Illustrated, with Horatio and Bernardo, Marcellus is not in the adaptation, seeming to come out of the watercolored fog that often serves as the moody backdrop of the story. Though much of the text is used, the test is not. Hamlet believes immediately, but the period pictured is conducive to such beliefs, and the comic book form is replete with the supernatural, so there is that built-in suspension of disbelief. I especially appreciate the way Mandrake nuances the lines by fiddling with the lettering. For example, Horatio's first line is rendered as, "Hail to your," then it changes bubbles in a smaller font, "Lordship," and then there's an asterisk. The asterisk and drop in volume make Horatio suddenly stop, perhaps realizing he has caught Hamlet in a private moment. He's awkward around the prince and later has a lot of hesitation in his speech. It goes, "My lord, the king, your father." It's a good line reading, and we could speculate about why Horatio is so awkward. Is it a natural class-based timidity? Is he self-conscious about Hamlet's grief, uncomfortable as many people are in such situations, or did Hamlet embarrass him with his funeral wedding crack? I'm less enthusiastic about one line change. "I think I saw him yesterday." Is yesternight so difficult a word to understand from the context? One thing that's a little off-putting about Mandrake's work in this adaptation is the way he moves the quote-unquote camera as we go from close-ups to spy shots where the characters are in silhouette behind window panes, to oddly angled top shots. This may be to create the sense of a disjointed Denmark, and on the second page of this scene, he creates an edgy broken glass panel layout that works in the same way. Hamlet has just heard about his father risen from the grave, and suddenly the panels are anxious and broken. His world is being shattered. It's a panel structure that does not recur again in the book. Mandrake has chosen it to be the pivotal moment upon which everything turns. After this point, there can be no turning back. I haven't really had this discussion before, but one could say that if Horatio had kept the ghost story to himself, the tragedy would not have happened. Metatextually, there's something interesting about the character who will become its teller in the last scene, causing it to happen in the first place. Horatio as Shakespeare himself. Now, in the French rock opera, this part of the scene is covered by a short 1 minute 15 second song called Le Spectre du Roi, The Spectre of the King.
Et qu'il revienne, comme je vous vois. J'irai au royaume des ombres, chercher le comment, le pourquoi. J'irai au royaume des ombres, chercher le comment, le pourquoi.
Quick translation. From the depths of the realm of shadows, the old king has returned to us. His shadow has come out of the shadows, and we saw him, we saw him. If the king refuses his tomb and he returns as I see you, I'll go to the realm of shadows, find the how and the why. I'll go to the realm of shadows, find the how and the why. The first four lines are choppily sung by a children's choir, turning Horatio and the soldiers into fairies or spirits. It's an odd choice, but Halliday does this a lot to differentiate Hamlet, his own voice, from other characters. It does work at setting up a supernatural element. Once those are done, the electric guitar jumps in. Hamlet is a rock star in this. And Joe Dassin-like, Hamlet speaks rather than sings his lines. This is his soliloquy, and the echo of his voice has the same effect as the voiceover used in some of the movie versions. He repeats the last lines a few times, shouting in the wilderness at nothing, and the music peters out before the end. Looking at the lyrics themselves, Halliday would have Hamlet go to hell itself to get answers from the ghost. Not something that happens in the play, but as we'll see, some directors like to turn the ghost's surroundings into a hellish place. And playing on the irony of the play, we might infer that the ghost may be able to walk the ground of Denmark because the country has slipped into an evil realm because of its corrupt leader. That's more food for thought. And it ends our look at Act 1, Scene 2, Part 3. Next time, Polonius has a chat with his kids. So if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and put keyboard to digital paper. I will read your feedback, likely once we've done with all of Act 1, if not sooner. A quirk of having pre-taped a lot of these before launching the first episode. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for Act 1, Scene 3.